like increase how we're introducing students to McGill as a whole, not just one day of Discover McGill and then Frosh. And I mean, Frosh is great, but you don't really learn anything about how to be an actual McGill student. How many are there? There are over 70 unique events and over 100 events going on throughout the week. They ran starting, I think, today and going through to Sunday, so they will overlap with Frosh. I already talked about hosting them. And who can participate in? That's any of your first years. We'll be probably participating in them throughout the week.
So most of you are Frosh leaders here, orientation leaders, and maybe not actually hosting these events. So how do these events relate to you as an orientation Frosh leader? Well, here's what we do expect from you when it comes to these events. So just that you're positive about them. So if one of your Froshies says that they're attending an event, you know, you don't have to ask a lot of questions or say, well, what's that? I've never heard of it. Just be like, that's really cool. Sounds interesting. Just be positive about it. I don't know. What do you kids say nowadays? That's awesome. Okay, so we don't have to go as far as saying that's cool. But just talk about it positively. You know, for all they know, this has been going on for years. You can be honest with them about that this was never something that you had. So, again, this is new to you, but just not being negative about it, we really appreciate, because that sets the tone for when they're leaders the following year. So allow their attendance. We have told the Froshies that they can attend events, these a la carte events that happen concurrently with Froshes. So just make sure that they know that they can attend that. And just promote mobility. What we mean by that is saying, okay, you can go to that event, and this is where we'll be when that event ends, and you can come back to us. So again, we're not saying take them there, but just let them know where you'll be when they're leaving and where you should be when they're coming back to you. And then promote sensible scheduling. So we understand that sometimes when they're leaving and coming back, it might really interfere with a large Frosh event that they should be with you. So we don't have a problem with you being honest and saying, if you attend that event, it might be really hard to come back. Here's how you could, but maybe you want to think about that and go to this event or skip this Frosh event entirely, but it's really up to you. So, you know, let them know when it looks like the schedule might be more difficult than just them coming back to the spot that they first let you at. So really be sensible about how they're scheduling. They're new to the campus. They may not know all the locations, so keep that in mind. And then communicate with them. So if you told them to meet you somewhere and then there's been a change to that, make sure they know. You should have their cell phones if they don't have a number yet. Maybe people you know who are around you where you are, you can tell them. So if they see one of your Froshies coming back looking all bewildered, they go, oh, are you the one looking for blank group? This is where they went. So just communicate with them because you might have Froshies coming and going. And just remember that a lot of these are also their introduction to services and clubs and groups that they really want to get to know. So on top of just having the social, of course, events of Frosh, these are really important to them too, especially if they're getting valuable information or meeting valuable groups and clubs that they want to get involved in. So a lot of these students are really interested in doing Frosh, but also have a vested interest in going to these events. So we really want to promote them going to it. Here's what we don't expect from you. We don't expect you to know about these events. You're probably hearing this for the first time. A la carte events, 100 events. There's not going to be a quiz. You really don't have to know what those are. You don't have to know the locations. There's an information booth near the Frosh registration booth that's manned by the first-year office staff and SMU. They know all the locations. All the locations are listed online. And you don't need to know the hosts or information about them. If someone says, oh, I hear it's hosted by Seed, and you happen to know that office and want to say something about it, fine. But be honest if you don't know anything about it, okay? So we're not expecting you to be experts in 100 events. That's me. And transport to and from events, as I said already, no need to get up with your Froshies and lead them there. If you think you can because you have support from your other Frosh leaders, feel free. But otherwise, it's up to them, and they can go to the information kiosk for information on how to get to their location. And we don't expect this to inconvenience your schedule. So I'll say again, if you really feel like it's going to be very hard for your Froshie to rejoin you and that they're going to be lost and you're going to be off campus and there's a lot of worries about that, we'd rather they be safe. Okay? So if it's going to inconvenience your schedule, make sure that you're honest with them about that and help promote their mobility as much as possible, even if it means being honest enough to say, I don't recommend you go to this. But hopefully, at the most, is that you're allowing them to go to these. Okay.
Okay, just so you don't really have to know what's going on. However, we do want you to make sure you're communicating with these people. So they are taking your kids. You may end up talking to one of them or this kind of thing. If there is a problem, for whatever reason, somebody is telling you, oh, you kids shouldn't go to Frosh, it's awful, these kind, like if they're really trying to bring it down or create a bad atmosphere, please tell your cores, your head of OSAF, whoever is around who can bring it up the chain. If it does become any type of issue you're having with one of these events, please let them know, and they will by extension let SMU or Mitchell know, and then we'll work it out with them. Just make sure we know, and we can deal with it from there.
So another thing is residences. So this year on your top five sheet that you all got in your folders, on the back there's a list of all the duty phone numbers for the people in the residences. So just a little note that those people who are on duty cannot leave their residence. So if you're calling, it's to tell them about something that's happening but not asking them to come to you. And just if you want to take the next time while we're on this slide, we didn't have Citadel's number in time. That's a new one. The numbers on there. So what we're asking you to do is, it's not if your Froshy is sleeping over at someone's house, but if there's a big emergency and they're in the hospital or they're coming back to that residence in a state that that duty person should really know about and be warned about, we ask that you take that extra minute to call that duty number and let them know, okay? Because communication with all these partners will make this year better, and in the future will just make organizing this a lot better and increases everybody's reputation, the week as a whole, and all you guys. Also, security. I know you can write those numbers in silence. Thanks. So security is a big partner here, too, and they'll be around on on-campus events, and they'll be giving all your Frosh coordinators any updates about if there's things happening in the city that you need to avoid. Okay, so also keep in mind that this year, if you don't have a Frosh bracelet, you can't be on the Frosh events, and security is a partner in that. So keep in mind, go to security if you need them, and you also really pay attention to the communication that you'll be getting from security, perchance by way of your Frosh coordinators.
Okay, and then finally, please be talking to your Froshies. Please don't leave anybody at the old port after the concert, for example. They're 18, they're confused, and if you lose one, it's your fault. So don't screw it up. Make sure you have their cell phone number. Just try to keep track of them to the best of your ability. You have all kinds of places to send them, numbers to call. You should be able to get them all home. And just be nice to them. Let them know what's going on.
So yeah, we should have 100 new events this year, which is almost five times what we had estimated as being the most. So we really appreciate you being partners in all this, and we think hopefully this will be the best orientation week ever. It's the first real orientation week as a whole, and just we really want students to be having an amazing time getting to know the city, the school, and everything there is to offer here. We really thank you again for coming today and your participation throughout the entire week and with these new events. Thank you so much.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mitch. Thanks, Katie. So I have the pleasure of introducing our guest today, who is the founder and chief catalyst of Nuance Leadership Incorporated, which helps organizations around the world increase their leadership capacity. Prior to funding Nuance, he was the director of one of Canada's largest university development programs and served as the national chair of Canada's largest fundraiser for college and university students, which raised and supported the works of Cystic Fibrosis Canada. He's spoken to just over 100,000 people around the world. He appeared on, earlier this year, he appeared on the main page of TED.com, where his talk has been viewed for over 500,000 times. Whew. His friends will tell you that he would be significantly more impressive if he didn't have an embarrassingly large stuffed penguin collection for a grown man. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Drew Dudley.
I've been told that at the age of 35, anything more than two stuffed penguins qualifies as an embarrassingly large stuffed penguin collection. I'm really nervous, and I speak a lot, and I'm really nervous because I'm in Montreal, and this is a wonderful city that hates me. Do you have a city that hates you? Because when I was 12 years old, I came to Montreal on a grade 8 class trip, and they left me behind. Which was fun, all right, so I got over that. And then I came back, and I stayed away until I was in first year university, and I was driving back to the East Coast, and I got in a terrible car accident on the highway driving through Montreal. And so I gave it a couple more years, and I came back, and I was robbed. And I gave it two more years, and I came back again, and I was robbed again. And this is my favorite. In 2009, I did a cross-Canada train trip, which you should do. It's amazing. And I got off the train in Montreal. I had such a good trip. I literally bounded off the train. It was kind of like, Montreal, you and I are going to be friends. And a guy walks up to me and decks me. a case of completely mistaken identity, but he just walked up and pounded me. And then he's like, oh, Jim, excuse. And I bolt. And I don't speak French that well, but I got, he looked mortified. And then he's booked. I'm like, thank you, my friend. So I'm thrilled to be here. And my job's amazing in that I get to travel around and I get to explore with people what leadership means to them and what it means to their communities and what it means to the people they care about. And I always marvel at how people answer a single question, no matter where they're from or how old they are and what they do. There's this one question that I've always been a little bit surprised by the answer. And I want to start by asking you guys the same question. How many of you are 100% completely and totally comfortable with calling yourself a leader? Not bad. Honestly, I've asked that question to every audience I've spoken to for 3 years, and no matter where I ask it, there's this huge portion of the audience that doesn't put up their hands. And you go to leadership conferences, you say, oh, it's for all the orientation leaders. I once did it with three mayors sitting in the front row, and they didn't put up their hand. And so I pointed it out, and then they looked very upset with me. It's like, you guys may want to raise your hands. I'm going, yeah, okay. But there's something about the term leader that I think we find difficult to connect to our own identity. There's something about the term that we find as if we have to be given permission to call ourselves leaders. Like, once you get a job title, or once someone says you're a leader, then we feel like we've accomplished something. But I found that people, they hesitate just claiming the title for themselves because they think it calls for a level of cockiness or arrogance that they don't want to be associated with. And what I worry about in our society is that we spend so much time celebrating amazing things that hardly anybody can do. What we've done is we've convinced ourselves that they're the only things we're celebrating. And what we do is we pick out these extraordinarily high achievers and we measure ourselves next to them. We say, look at Warren Buffett invest, and look at Steve Jobs innovate, and look at Madonna perform, and look at Tiger Woods used to play golf. Or do any number of other things. And we say, that's where the bar is. And if we're not playing at that level, then we have no right to call ourselves leaders. And what I've discovered is the problem with that is when you hold yourself up, and that's how you decide to measure yourself as leaders, inevitably we devalue the leadership contributions that we do make. And what we do is we let moments of leadership pass by, we don't let ourselves feel good about them, and we don't let ourselves take credit for them. And because I think as humans, we tend to do the things that we feel good about most often, when we look at leadership like that, as having to be these big things, I think that what we're doing is we allow moments to pass by and we pull leadership out of our lives. We pull leadership out of our communities. We pull it out of the world, and I think we need it. Instead, what we've done is we made it into something bigger than us, something beyond us, something that we think isn't connected to what our identity is. And I've been incredibly lucky over the past 15 years that I've worked with these amazing people who've helped me redefine what leadership means to me. And it's made my life better. And what I want to do today is share with you some of the story of that redefinition in the hope that it resonates with some of you guys. That's not going to flip over, but I'm going to start the... If someone wants to... Can you sit the space bar on that? Because there's a really cute picture of me. There we go. Adorable. You know what? Thank you for that. But you didn't whistle when I got up here, and I'm the same guy. So all you just did was remind me I've gone so far downhill since then. Thank you. Thank you. That's it. Get them to pity you, Drew. Now they're in the palm of your hand. But this is me right before I graduated high school. At this particular point in my life, I thought that I was everything that you were supposed to be as a student because I had done everything that I was told to do. Like, I graduated high school with a 99.3 average. Yeah, and I was ticked about the 0.7. I was that guy. And I did everything that looked good on paper. I was valedictorian and captain of the football team and editor of the school paper and president of the student union. Because only in high school can you control the government and the press at the same time. Nobody cares. I had an ex-girlfriend once. Actually, now that I think of it, she's still an ex-girlfriend. I had a girlfriend once and she said, Drew, I have to love you for your heart because your brain is a scary-ass place to visit. So let's visit there for a minute. This is how I thought about education. I thought that education, the entire experience, was about looking good on paper. And specifically one type of paper, the double-sided sheet of paper, the resume. And on that went all of your grades, and on that went all of your extracurriculars, and on that went all of my awards. Like, and I had convinced myself that I only had a certain amount of time to work on this double-sided sheet of paper, from kindergarten until the time you're done university. That's how long you have to work on it. And after that, You have to turn it in, and then you're judged. And in that time, from kindergarten to the time you're done university, not only did it have to be great, it had to be better than yours, and it had to be better than yours, and it had to be better than yours. Because I figured out the first time that I got a grade that we were competing for something. And I didn't know what it was, because I was six. But I thought, why are they ranking us if it's not to make sure the people at the top get something the people at the bottom don't get? And so I killed myself to look good on paper. And I ended up getting to go to any school I wanted to. And I ended up going to this tiny little school on the east coast of Canada called Mount Allison University. A lot of people giggle at that. Mount A has 2,200 people. It's had 2,200 people for 70 years. And it's located in Sackville, New Brunswick, which is as exciting as it sounds. And when I got to Mount A, I still had to be that guy. I had to be the best student in first year, and I had to be an RA right away, and I had to be an orientation leader right away. I had to be the guy that on the first day I wanted the professor to be able to say, that one there, that one's special. Because I figured that was the key, is that you had to look good on paper and you had to impress professors. And then I met this guy, and if you don't mind popping over to the next slide. I was like that until I met a guy. Not in the tell me more, like does he have a car sort of way. Thank you all still watch musicals. But I met this guy named Jason Abraham. Now, Jason was my manager at the campus bar. I paid my way through school by bartending. And Jason was the coolest guy on campus. And I had wanted to be cool since I was old enough to know that I wasn't. So, like, four. And if you ever work at a bar, you know that sometimes that you can stick around after work as a rookie, and they'll give you some extra orientation. And I was there one night with Jason, and I got him into one of those really awkward conversations. I was like, Jason, man, everybody loves you. And you can see him start, like, his eyes start darting for the doors, like, get me out of this. And I was like, everybody loves you, man. You're so cool. Can you teach me how to be cool? I know. Rule number one of being cool, please do not ask people to tell you how to be cool. And Jason's such a good guy. He laughs and he goes, all right, I'm going to tell you something my grandmother taught me. And I don't know about you, when you go to cool school, one of the last people you expect on faculty is grandma. But Jason says, my grandmother told me that your life is better the fewer times you feel forced to say, I'm sorry. And if you want to pull I'm sorry's out of your life, all you do is this. Every time you talk about somebody, act as if they're standing directly behind you. Your life will just be easier. And that is the best advice I have ever been given that I ignore on a daily basis. Every time you talk about someone, act as if they're standing directly behind you. It's not even a moral or ethical thing. It just makes life easier. And this is how the guy talked. And no one talks like that because it sounds like an after-school special. But that's how Jason actually was. And that's why people adored him. And in February of 2000, he started dropping a bunch of weight. And he finally got dragged to the hospital because when you go to Sackville, New Brunswick, you don't go get a doctor. You wait until you're really sick and then your roommates drag you to the emergency room while you plead, I'm fine, don't bug me. And they said, you have a horrible flu, because he said, I got a fever, I'm achy all over, I'm losing a bunch of weight, I have no appetite. And they said, brutal flu, it's been bad this year, they sent him home. He goes back the next week, and he's like, actually, even now I'm feeling like there's something really up. And they said, look, it's been a terrible year for this, go home, you'll be fine. He lost 34 pounds in 17 days. And finally, his friends were like, hey, let's try a different hospital. So they take him to a different hospital, and finally somebody figures out that Jason has a tumor in his stomach. And they say to him, look, with this type of cancer, if you catch it early, there's a really high cure rate. So we're going to go get it right now. And they airlift him to Toronto because that's where his family and his girlfriend was. And they went in to get this cancer early. But when they went in there, they discovered that it was everywhere. There was not a single symptom until it was too late. And they had to come out and tell his family and his girlfriend that Jason is never leaving the hospital. It might be a week, maybe two, but he won't live a month. And why I love my little school in the middle of nowhere, East Coast Canada, is because they decided that they wanted this guy to be a graduate before he died. And so even though he would never come back and finish the last three courses he wanted, they got the Senate together and they voted to give him a degree, which they can do. A university can give a degree to anyone they want. And so they said, we're going to give it to Jason. But they didn't just give him his degree. They got his four best boys from the hockey team together. They brought him in. They said, look, we're going to fly you to Toronto on our dime, and we want you to deliver this to him. We want you to tell him that we're incredibly proud of him. And we wanted to make sure that he got what he came for. And they hand him the scroll. So his boys get on a plane, they fly to the hospital. Well, they fly to the airport and then go to the hospital. And they walk in, and Jason's like, what are you doing here? And they hand out the scroll. They hold it out, and they're like, everyone's so proud of you. We wanted to make sure that you got what you came for. And they hold this thing out. And what I was told later is that Jason looks at his boys, and he looks at the sheet of paper. He goes, get what I came for. Guys, I didn't go there to get that. I went there to get all of you. I have everything I need from that school, so tell them thank you so much, but if I can't get it myself, I don't want it. And, of course, that goes back to the campus and rips around in about 30 seconds. And it blew my mind because I was 23 years old, I think, at the time, and that was the first time it had ever occurred to me that anyone would ever go to school for any reason other than to finish it. And it blew my mind because, unfortunately, Jason didn't get to get his degree. He died on the 27th of March 2000, which was 1 month and 9 days after they said he wouldn't live a month, and 12 days before he turned 24. And his death changed everything about leadership and everything about life for me, because when he died, I watched something happen that I'd never seen before. And an entire town went into mourning. Like, everyone, the students, the staff, the faculty, the people who drove cabs, the people who made pizzas, like, everybody acted like they'd lost a brother. And I'd never seen a single person matter to so many people up close and personal. And your brain goes into really dark places at that time, and I asked myself, like, Drew, what if it was you? Like, what if it was you who never left the hospital? Would this many people care? And that's a really crappy question to ask yourself. And the problem is, when you've been valedictorian and voted most likely to, and you've been told your whole life as a student that you're doing everything exactly right, when you realize that the answer to that question is no, you wouldn't matter to as many people, it is earth-shaking for you. Because that's what I realized. And then I held up that double-sided sheet of paper that I'd worked so hard for in my life. I held it up in my head next to his, and I realized, you know what? I'm so much more impressive than this guy on paper. But he matters so much more than I do. There's no question that he matters more. And then I realized something. That's probably because he had lived his life to matter to people. I had lived my life to look good on paper. He had lived his life to have an impact on the people around him. And I had lived my life to impress people I never met yet who one day I hope would hire me. I lived my life for the piece of paper that they brought him in the hospital. He lived his life for the guys who brought it. And that's a fundamental difference. And I realized that I think one of the things that we have to start teaching earlier is that leadership is about whether or not you can matter and now, not like you're training to matter sometime later. And I think that you guys have been asked so many questions as part of your education. And one of the ones I want to ask you is this. Why do you matter? Because it boggles my mind as I go around and I ask university students, leaders, extraordinary people, why do you matter? And they look at me as if I punched them in the gut. Like I'm in Montreal in a train station. Because honestly, like they can come up with something, but the struggles that people have to answer that question, why do you matter, makes me wonder how can we call it an education system? Because I bet you can all come up with something, but you shouldn't have to work this hard, and it shouldn't be the first time that somebody asked you. And you're going to be dealing with an awful lot of people walking into this place. Start right away helping them realize that their education isn't just about impressing someone they haven't met yet. Their education is about how much that they matter. And after Jason died, I was lucky enough to work to create a project called Conic Becoming, Voices Against Cancer. It was a compilation of all the musicians on our campus. Because we said, wouldn't it be cool if? And I think that wouldn't it be cool if is the most powerful phrase in youth. Because if you take youth and energy and friendship and the phrase, wouldn't it be cool if, and you put it together, I've seen extraordinary things happen. And I will tell all of you this, that you will never again be in a place with this much talent, this much energy, this much passion, this much skill, all willing to work for free. You guys aren't getting a lot of checks for this gig, are you, right? But you look around. You'll never again in your life be around this much of that. Seize it. What is your wouldn't it be cool if? And then go and do it, because you're surrounded by extraordinary people who are going to cost $500 an hour soon. So get them when they won't charge you that. And they're in this room right now. Do you mind flipping forward a couple of slides? What I love to do is I love to take lyrics from that project. Just keep rolling a little bit. And one more. I like to take lyrics from... back one more. Thanks, my friend. Lyrics from that project to attribute to our friend and talk about how they tie into leadership. And I've got a couple of them for you here. Every time I change, I'm more like me than I was before. This was written after a breakup where all the best music is written. This was written after a public breakup, the best kind, where you don't want to watch it, but you can't turn away. And a buddy of mine was getting yelled at by his girlfriend because she said, you're not the guy I started dating. And he's like, that was 4 years ago. I hope I'm not. And then she goes, you will never, ever date another girl like me. And he's like, that's kind of the idea. I know. Like, you live your life to get teed up like that, you know? Like, just once in your life, thank you. But I think the change is such an important part of leadership. Dealing with change, being able to adapt to change. The people that you're going to be helping here are coming through a massive change in their life. You guys are still in the middle of a change. What I've discovered in working with students is that you guys are amazing at identifying things in the world that have to change. If there is a social justice issue that needs addressing, you're all over it. If there's a disease we need to eradicate, you're all over it. If there's something about the world, if there's a charity that needs support, you are all over it. But when it comes to changing our own lives, there is something about it that holds us back. And I want to tell you the story, if we can flip one more slide, of the woman who changed how I think of change. She's on the left. Her name is Allison Elwood. The girl next to her with her arm around her is my high school crush. Her name was Megan. Her name still is Megan. The funny thing is we're still friends, so when she said, I just want to be friends, she actually wasn't lying. But I asked her to prom 3 times. It didn't work out. But when I was at university, I discovered that I had this talent. I could get people to give me money. Not just walk up and be like, can I have 20 pounds? But companies would give me sponsorships or for charities. And one of the things that will happen if you get really good at getting other people's money is that your friends will ask you to do it all the time. And I got a call from Megan in 2006, and she said, I have this really amazing woman that you have to meet. And I was like, sweet. And she said, not like that. Why is it never like that? And she said, she's got this initiative that you really, really have to help her with. And so I met Allison, and she told me the story of her mom. And she said, 2 years ago, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. And as soon as she was diagnosed, she started getting sicker and sicker because she wouldn't let anybody in. She wouldn't let her family in. She wouldn't let the people who cared about her because she said, this is my fight, and I won't drag down the people that I love as I fight this. So just leave me alone, and I'll deal with it. And she said, my mom kept getting worse and worse. And then she met this woman one day in a grocery store. I don't know if you've ever dealt with a problem. You don't tell your friends. You don't tell your family. You meet a stranger, and you're like, here's the whole story. And she did. And this woman, it turns out, was a breast cancer survivor. And she said, well, you've got to go out for coffee. And they went out for 5.5-hour coffee. And this woman told Allison's mom all about her fight with breast cancer. And Allison said, that woman's story saved my mom's life. And there's this amazing guy named James Miskalik. He wrote a book called 6 Months in Sudan about working with Doctors Without Borders. And when I was working with him once, he told me that the story is the basic unit of human understanding. And I love that idea, that the story is the basic unit of human understanding. And what I worry about is this, is so many people I work with of all ages are either unwilling or unable to tell their own story. They think it's dumb, they think it's boring, they think it's not as impressive as somebody else's. The questions I think are really important in your education that I want to add to is this one. What is your story and why does it matter? Because someone out there will be changed by your story. It may not be the whole world that will be changed by it, but there is someone that you're going to connect with at some point in your life that will be changed by your story if you're willing to share it. So start figuring it out and start sharing it as much as you can. And Alice said, I want every woman in Canada who's diagnosed with breast cancer, and it's 1 in 5 Canadian women, I want them to feel the same sort of hope that my mom did from hearing that woman's story. So I want to ride my bike from Victoria, British Columbia, all the way to Cape Spear, Newfoundland, 5 months, and I want to meet these women, and I want to collect the stories of women who have battled and beaten breast cancer. And I said, amazing. And I helped her out. And I'm flipping to the next one. And she actually goes all the way across. It took her 5 months. She's a force of nature. And I said, can you come in and please tell my first-year students at U of T your story? Because my first-year students, and many of the ones that you guys are going to help welcome here, are in this incredible, and some of you are still in this battle too, this battle between figuring out what it is they want in their life or knowing what they want in their life and trying to please their parents and everybody who cares about them. And this is this constant juggling act. And Allison fought with her parents so badly over this trip. And she goes, I look back now and I realize what I was saying to my dad is that one of the women you love is fighting cancer and the other one wants to leave. I was saying to my mom, while you're doing this, I'm going to go off and ride my bike through the woods. And she goes, but at the time, all I kept doing was fighting and fighting, and finally, they let me do it. And I said, well, how? And she goes, I pulled a cheap shot. I told them I love them. She goes, I told them that I could never repay them for everything that they'd done. I said, I never had enough words to describe how much I owed them. And I know that all they wanted out of me was to be a daughter that they could be proud of. But I knew that I couldn't be a daughter that they could be proud of until I was a daughter that I'm proud of. And to do that, I have to do things I believe in. And she goes, my dad looks at my mom and then looks at me, looks back at my mom and goes, she's you. I hate that. And then he looked at me and said, and I love it, so go do it. So I brought her in, and she's got a room like this full of first years, and she's telling her story, and in their eyes, I'm watching her become what she is, this extraordinary woman to look up to, someone to want to emulate. Until the very end of the presentation, the Q&A, and one of my students puts up their hand and asks, hey, what school did you go to? Because everything she said wasn't valid unless the answer to that question is a good enough school, right? What school did you go to? And she laughs and she goes, oh my God, a better question would be, what school didn't I go to? I dropped out 3 times before I graduated, twice. And she said, I was told that university was all about freedom. And on the first day I went there, and 5 different professors handed me a double-sided sheet of paper with what I had to do, how many words I had to do it in, how big my margins were allowed to be, and what happened to me if I didn't hand it in when they asked for it. She goes, that didn't look like freedom to me, so I bailed. Then I went to college and left that and went back to university. She goes, eventually I got 2 degrees, but yeah, a better question would be, what school didn't I go to? And my student's response to that answer is one I will never forget. because she instantly went from being someone to look up to being a cautionary tale. Like, they looked at her like she had done something wrong. And I realized at that moment how extraordinarily powerful the list is. And there is a list that exists in everybody's head of the things that you think you have to do for your life to be a success. And over again, over 10 years in working in higher education, I've watched students come into universities with this list in their head that they think they have to complete in order to be a person of worth. And what bothers me the most is that it seems to be that we've started to believe that any deviation from this list, no matter how extraordinary it might be, no matter how exciting it might be, no matter how right for you it might be, is seen as reckless and foolish and stupid. Because, yeah, there's lots of different ways to be successful, but there's a guaranteed way, so why would you screw with it? And I think the list looks like this. Go to kindergarten and play nice. Go to elementary school and do what the teacher tells you. Go to high school so that you can go to a good university, which usually means doing what the teacher tells you. Go to university so you can get a big, fat starting salary. Get a big, fat starting salary. Get promoted. Get yourself into a serious, long-term relationship. Get promoted. Get married. Get promoted. Buy a house. Get promoted. Have kids. Get promoted. Get promoted a couple more times. Retire and make sure your kids do exactly the same thing. And I watch us sometimes act as if our entire lives are some sort of giant scavenger hunt, and we're all handed out an identical card at the beginning, and it has that list on it, and we are told, quick, get as many check marks as you can, because everybody else is racing with you. And I loved that game, because I was told very early in my life, Drew, you have the ability to destroy that list, and we expect that from you. And is there any worse feeling than feeling like you're going to let down people who believe in you? And one of the things that you can help is help people deal with that terrible fear when they walk through these doors. And one of the easiest ways you can do it is by telling them that you felt it too. Because I bet you that more than a few of you actually did. That list becomes a prison. And I think it is because we overuse this one idea. There are so many things that are learned but never explicitly taught in education. One of them is this. If you just work hard enough, it will all pay off in the end. But over and over again, I'm starting to understand that we never tell you how hard is hard enough, do we? And we don't do a good enough job helping you figure out what you want the actual payoff in your life to be. And we never tell you when the end will come. So we have all these amazing young people chasing an undefined goal on an undefined timeline. And you just sort of start to believe that as soon as you get the piece of paper, it'll be okay. But then what happens if 3 months after you graduate, if it hasn't all worked out, everyone starts asking, what's wrong with me? One thing I've learned about leadership is that it's not about getting better. It's about recognizing that there's nothing wrong with you. And that, honestly, what you need to do is shift how you think and what you do every day to remind yourself of that more frequently. But don't let these students come in here just buy into this idea that if you just work hard enough, it will all pay off in the end. It's a lot more deliberate than that. And I want to tell you that that idea I've watched make thousands of young people believe that what their professors think of them and what their potential future employers think of them is somehow more important than what you think of yourself. And I've watched it make thousands of young people like you believe that the entire purpose of the educational experience is to figure out what the market wants so you can learn it and turn around and offer it right back to the market, regardless of whether it has anything to do with what you love, what you care about, or what you're gifted at. And worse of all, it tells all of the dancers and the musicians and the actors and the entrepreneurs and the change agents and everyone in this room whose brilliance cannot be measured on by essays and on tests, it tells you that your gifts aren't gifts at all. They should only be gifts if one day they can be monetized. Otherwise, they should just be hobbies. And I think that we can start to change that culture. And I think that you can let them know that that's not what this place is about. It's just figuring out what the market wants so that one day you can deliver it. It's figuring out what you want so that one day you can deliver that to you. Because there's one day I was sitting there, and I was 27 years old, and I had the most liberating and terrifying day of my life because I was beating myself up because I hadn't gotten something done on the list in time. And for the first time in my life, I looked at it, and I was like, I didn't write this. Like, I was living my life according to somebody else's agenda. And I don't know what the list is in your head. I don't know what list you're trying to chase so that you feel like you're a success. And I don't know what the list that all these students who are coming in are going to be chasing so that they feel like they're a person of worth. All I can ask you and what I encourage you to tell them is that whatever your list is, make sure that you wrote it. Make sure it's not your parents or your professors or your brothers and your sisters or your boyfriends or your girlfriends or what you think society expects from you. Because I guarantee you, if you spend your life chasing a list of other people's goals, I don't care how many of them you reach, you will always feel unfulfilled. There are four things that I tremendously believe let more people raise their hands, and they create extraordinary communities. And if you believe in them too, please pass them on to the students coming in here. But more importantly, pass them on to yourself whenever you need to. And here's the four things that I've learned are incredibly true about school and leadership. One, you are far more brilliant than you give yourself credit for. And you are far more brilliant than the tests that we are forced to give you allow you to show. Two, school is the last place that you'll spend time in your life where the ability to do well on a test is valued more than the ability to actually do something. or change something or help someone. And hopefully you will spend so much more time in your life doing things, changing things, and helping people than you will writing tests. I think you owe it to yourself to make sure that you walk out of this place as good at doing those things as you are at writing tests. The third one is that success in leadership cannot be measured by money and by titles. And straight A's will not get you a direct path to either one of those things. Success and leadership come from striving to act every day in a way that makes it more likely you'll have a positive impact on your own life and on the lives of other people. And if we create a culture here where that becomes what people strive to, can I add value to myself and to other people every day? It's extraordinary what happens. And the last one is this. You should work incredibly hard to make your grades extraordinary. You should. Your grades will open doors for you. Your grades will kick down doors for you. Your transcript is an incredibly important part of your life. However, I think we have to make sure we recognize that it is not a measure of your worth as a human being. And I think that we have to make sure that this is not a place where people who are D students believe that they are D people. And we let too many people think that way. And I think that you can play a role in starting to change that. You should work incredibly hard to make your grades extraordinary. But this is the part that which was written in 10-foot letters everywhere, on every educational institution in the world. Work incredibly hard to make your grades extraordinary, and then work twice as hard to make sure that they are the least impressive thing about you. And I think if you do that, success is going to follow you everywhere that you go. And I think that we can start to tell first years the same thing. And I think it changes so much. The next quote that I wanted to go as I start to close off is that... Oh, sorry. That's probably some sort of terrible thing to do. I think we equate change with failure. And I think we have to let go of that. I think we say if we change something, it means we have to admit we screwed up the first time. If we decide to study something different, if we decide to go to a different school, if we decide to date someone different, what we think to ourselves is that I have to admit to myself and everybody watching that I messed up the first time. As long as we equate change with failure, we will not welcome it into our lives. Education is an exploration, life is an exploration, and there is no exploration without change. Please let the people who come in here and let yourself know this, that any decision you make here can be changed, and it doesn't make you stupid when you do. If I could flip one more. You say you never got... I guess I took out the wrong slide. Oh, you say you never got to know the real me, neither did I. We are our own worst subjects. How many of you know how much money you made at your last part-time job per hour over the summer? Honestly, how many know how much meant money? Okay, cool. How many of you have a general idea what your GPA is? How many of you know who sings Party in the USA? How many of you could tell me the single happiest moment of your life? Money, Marks, and Miley, no problem. Happiest moment of our lives, half of the people keep their hands down. I think part of it is because we focus on the wrong things when we evaluate ourselves as people and as leaders. I have two quick stories and I'm going to get off the stage. When I was 19 years old, I was heartbreakingly head over heels, deathly, cannot live without her, in love with this girl. I think her name was Megan. Yeah. Megan and I did not work out. But in order to, Sackville's a tiny place, and no one sticks around this summer, and she was staying to do research. And I'm no math wizard, but I figured that, look, if 90% of the men leave town, my chances with Megan will increase exponentially. So I would like to stay in town. And so I stayed, and I ended up taking a job as a fundraiser running a campaign called Shinorama Students Fighting Cystic Fibrosis. 65 colleges and universities across Canada do it. We were 65th best. Some of you do math. We made $260 the year before we took over, and the number one school in the country made $168,000. Yeah, so we had a little bit of work to do. And we ended up making $15,000. And this year, the next year, we said, okay, well, now we've done it once, so we're experts. We're going to make $20,000. And on the day that we were supposed to go out and make $20,000 and execute the greatest fundraising plan ever, which I can say with great confidence because we never had to do it, so you can't prove me wrong, there was a hurricane, a full-fledged hurricane. Although someone told me that it was only 74 miles per hour, so technically it was a tropical storm. I was in it. It was a hurricane. And my ideas about leadership changed by these guys that I never met. And they worked in a strip mall in Moncton. And I had sent out 12 volunteers to wash cars in a hurricane. And these guys told me later they were spraying each other with a hose to make themselves feel drier. Like it was coming down. And these guys in the print shop saw my poor frost shift there, drenched. And they said, we have to do something for them. So they went to their banner-making machine, and they made a huge banner that said, yes, it's raining, but we have soap. Come on. I don't know how they captured come on, but they did it. They laminate it, they take it out to the students who think it's the greatest thing they've seen. They unfold it, and they stand in the middle of the street in Moncton, New Brunswick, and they're like, Drew, it was amazing. Everyone turned in to get their car washed. I'm like, were you blocking the street? And they're like, yeah, but they wanted to. We could tell. And by the way, washing your car in a hurricane means you spray it with dish soap and let it drive away. But people did stuff like that, and we ended up making $18,000, which was more than we'd ever done before in a hurricane. So I was like, amazing. That was the best leadership ever, because I went, figure it out, go. But I really thought that considering everything that we'd faced, we'd done really well. The problem was, 2 days later, I was reminded how much of what we think of ourselves we allow to be shaped by other people. Because one of the local papers ran an article on our record-breaking campaign, and the headline was, Shinerama comes up $2,000 short. And my heart made this awful noise, and my mouth made way worse noises. I was going around to international students being like, what is the worst swear word in your language? What is the worst swear word in your language? But I thought, you know what? Leaders don't set goals and then give themselves excuses to be like, well, it wasn't what we expected. So I said, leaders admit that they failed and then work to fix it. And so I let myself feel that I failed. And then a girl walked into a bar. And it's not a joke. She actually walked into my bar. 2 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday. And she marches up to me and she looks up and goes, hi, I'm a geek. And I have no idea what the conversational etiquette is when someone leads with, hi, I'm a geek. So I went with the international symbol for I have no idea where this conversation is going. Okay. And she says, no, I have to go to medical school. I mean, I have to go to medical school. So all I do is study. But I love to dance. I mean, I freaking love to dance. So I give myself the first week of every semester to come to this bar and dance until you throw me out. And for 2 years I've done that now as a frosh. And now a second year. And every single night I left this place at 2 in the morning and I walked by the student union office and I saw your Shinerama team making donation boxes or painting signs, sending emails. Drew, I watched you give 12 speeches in 2 nights to try to get people to come out and do this campaign. And I wanted to tell you that I've never seen a group of people care more about anything in my life. And I wanted to tell you that I noticed and I'm not the only one. And I feel better there are people like you in the world. And then she hands me an envelope and walks off. Now, if you would like someone to cruise on a compliment for 13 years, may I highly recommend I Feel Better There Are People Like You in the World. And so I'm walking over to my co-chair. She was working with me that night. And I was opening the envelope, figuring that she'd written a little note as well. But by the time I got to my co-chair, I was completely messed up because in the envelope was a personal check from a 21-year-old girl for $2,000. And she wrote in the memo line for inspiration rendered because it wasn't cool if there wasn't a note. Right? She gave me $2,000. And I had never seen her before in my life. And two things ripped through my mind. Oh my God, somebody was watching. And then, oh my God, somebody was watching. Because that's the thing about these roles through orientation that we give up sleep and we give so much of ourselves to. I think that sometimes in the process of trying to do the things that we think will make us look the best, we act in ways that would make us look the worst. And we tell ourselves it'll be okay. By the time, I'll look so good at the end, it won't matter how I got there. Or more frequently in our lives, we say, once I get there, I will have so much more money, or so much more time, or so much more influence, I will do so much good that I will fix it. Every time we act like less than we are, every time we act like less than we want to be, we're pulling leadership out of our lives. This job that you have is such an amazing opportunity to look cool. It's a much better opportunity to actually be cool. I think that there's an old phrase that says, you're only as good as you are when nobody's watching. And I always like to change it to say, you're only as good as you are when no one's watching because someone's always watching. Some of you are in this room as a leader because of your leader. And probably you watch them all the time. There is no off switch to this job. And sometimes that sucks. But we put so much focus on what people think of us on the things that we're paying attention to. That woman showed me that it wasn't so much the things I did that impressed her. It's how I went about doing it. And I think we have to realize that we put so much stress into how we look that a lot of what people think of us is formed in the moments we're not paying attention to. And I know that we put a lot of focus on our plans. Malcolm Gladwell says that dreams don't come true, goals come true. And goals without plans are just dreams. So have plans. But I want to tell you that I bet you the biggest impact you have in this world as a leader, in this job and well beyond, will have very little to do with your plans. The biggest legacy you're going to leave behind will have everything to do with the unplanned consequences of your everyday actions. I'm going to tell you one orientation week story to close that really encapsulates everything that changed for me about leadership. When I left Mount Allison, I was there for 7 years because, well, I caught pneumonia in that hurricane. I also had keys to the bar, and let's face it, you never at 22, you don't leave when that's the case. So I was sticking around, and when I finally left after 7 years, this girl walks up to me on my goodbye party, and she goes, Drew, I remember the first time I met you. And don't you love it when people use your name and you don't know who they are? Thanks, kiddo. Big guy. And she goes, you have no idea who I am. And I said, oh, no. She goes, no, it's okay, but I want to tell you the story of the first time I met you. And I thought, this could be awesome or this could not be good. And she told me a story from 4 years earlier. She goes, the night before I started university, I was in a hotel room with my mom and my dad. And I all of a sudden was so convinced I wasn't ready for this that I started to cry. And my parents hadn't seen me cry in 8 years. But it's a hotel room. There's nowhere to hide. So they were awesome. They were like, look, we know you're scared. Trust us. We are way more scared than you are. But you've worked so hard for this, you owe it to yourself to go on the first day. So let's go tomorrow, and if at any point you think you can't do it, just tell us, we will take you home. We love you no matter what. And she goes, I'd worked my whole life for this. So I went on the first day, and everyone was wearing goofy stuff. Everyone had weird face paint on. They were doing these pelvic thrusts. They were screaming. Please don't do it. I mentioned that once. The entire school got up and did it. It's not cool. And she goes, I thought, again, here I am at a place where only extroverts are valued, and I spent my whole life there. I didn't want to do it anymore, so I quit. Standing in line, I quit. And as soon as I did, I was overcome with this feeling of incredible peace, like I'd done the right thing. So I turned to my mom and my dad to tell them to take me home like they said they would. And at that moment, you came out of the nearest building wearing the stupidest hat I have ever seen in my life. That hat was awesome. I don't care what she says. It was like Dumbledore's hat and Gandalf's hat. It had like a little baby hat. And she said you had a big sign that said, Shiner Am, a student's fighting cystic fibrosis. And you had a bucket full of lollipops. And you were walking along and you were handing out these lollipops to people in line to try to get them to do Shiner Am. If I look back, I was probably hitting on Frosh Girls, but whatever. She wants to make me a noble fundraiser. Kudos to her. But she's like, you're walking along and you're handing out these lollipops. All of a sudden, you just stopped and you stared at me. It was creepy. She goes, then you looked at the guy next to me and you smiled. And you pulled out a lollipop and you held it out and you're like, dude, you've got to give a lollipop to the beautiful girl that you were standing next to in line. Don't screw this up, man. And she goes, I've never seen this guy before, but I've never seen a human being get more embarrassed faster in my life. He turns beet red, just does this with the lollipop. So I feel bad for this guy because everyone in line is looking at him. So I take the lollipop. And as soon as I do, you get this really severe look on your face. And you look at my parents and you're like, look at your little girl. Look at what your little girl is doing. It is her first day away from home. Her first day on her own. And already she is taking candy from a complete and total stranger. And she goes, everybody loses it. For like 20 feet in every direction, everyone starts to laugh. And she goes, I don't know why, but in that moment when everyone was laughing, I just switched. I just changed my mind. And I haven't talked to you in the 4 years since that day, but I heard that you were leaving. And before that happened, I had to come up to you and tell you that you have been an incredibly important person in my life. And I'm really going to miss you. So good luck, all right? And she just walks off. And I'm standing there going, why does this keep happening to me? But she gets about 6 feet away and she comes back and she goes, there's one more thing that you should probably know. I've been dating that guy for 4 years since that day. Oh, wait. A year and a half after I moved to Toronto, they invited me to their wedding. She married the dude. Good luck, by the way. Here's the thing. I don't remember that. Like, I have searched my memory banks because I was awesome in that moment, and I would like to remember being that awesome once in my life. I do not have any recollection of that. And that's a big eye-opener for me. And that's really what I like to talk about when it comes to leadership, is that maybe the biggest moment of leadership in my life, maybe the biggest impact I had on another person in my life, like a moment that had a girl walk up to a complete stranger 4 years later and say, you have been an incredibly important part of my life, is a moment I didn't even remember. And I think that this job, and really our lives, keep handing us moments like that if we're willing to look for them. Like, how many of you guys have what I would refer to as a lollipop moment, which is a moment where someone said something or did something that made you feel as if your life was fundamentally better? But raise your hands if you had a lollipop moment. Very cool. Now, all of those of you raised your hands, how many of you have told the person who created that moment that they created that moment? Like a third, if that. I don't get that. Like, we live in a world where we celebrate birthdays where all you have to do is not die for 365 days and we will throw you a party. Sit, like, don't get speed bumped by a bus, you get a cake. But people who have fundamentally made our lives better, we let them walk around and we don't tell them that. If you get nothing else from today, if you want to know where I think leadership honestly comes from, please tell the people who made your life better that they made your life better, because it makes them do it again. It makes them realize that they're far more powerful than they think. And every single one of you has been the catalyst for a lollipop moment. Every one of you will be in this job. Remember that they swing both ways, though. It's as easy to cut as it is to build up. But I think that it's frightening to believe that we can be that powerful. I think it's scary to think that we could have that kind of impact on an everyday basis, because as long as we keep leadership something bigger than us, as long as we keep leadership something beyond us, as long as we keep it about changing the world, what we're doing is we're giving ourselves an excuse to not expect it from ourselves and from each other every day. We're lowering the bar to make life easier, not to make it better, because once you acknowledge you can do it, every day that you don't, I think you have to admit to yourself that you left something on the table. And I think that Marianne Williamson wrote this extraordinary poem, it's almost getting cliched now, but I do love it, that says, "Our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our greatest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light and not our darkness that frightens us." And I think if we're going to see more people raise their hands, I think if we're going to create the community that's possible at amazing places like this, we have to get over that fear so that we can move beyond it. And our little brothers and our little sisters and all the first years that are coming here can watch us value how much we can matter to each other every day more than money and power and influence and prestige. I think it's time to redefine leadership. I think it's time to redefine it as being about lollipop moments. How many of them we create, how many of them we say thank you for, and how many of them we pay forward. Because somewhere along the way, guys, I think we made leadership about changing the world. And there is no world. There's just 7 billion understandings of it. And that means that once you change one person's understanding of it, like one person's understanding of what they're capable of, or one person's understanding of how many people care about them, or one person's understanding of how powerful an agent for change they can be in their own lives and in this world. I think every time you change one person's understanding of it, you've changed the whole world. That's not beneath any of us. It's not beyond any of us. And you're about to be handed an opportunity to do it every day on a platter. I think that's a remarkable opportunity and a tremendous responsibility. I think it's one that I hope that you have a tremendously good time seizing. I think if we can redefine leadership like that, I think if we understand leadership like that, I think we can change everything. And I think that that's a simple idea, but it doesn't mean that it's a small one. And I want to thank you guys so much for actually letting me get through this without something horrible happening to me in Montreal. Guys, thank you so very, very much. That was awesome work with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Drew. Okay. We're almost going to start the next segment. Could I ask all the facilitators in the room in the green shirts and purple shirts just to meet Alia outside? Thank you. Thanks so much. Just a reminder again, everyone should have their bookmark filled out. Just some housekeeping while we have a moment. Oops. Okay, so we have one more presentation before we send you, as Mike said, out. And I'm going to get this up. I think we're going to go up here. And okay. And then this microphone works. Is it okay with this? You're going to do this. Okay. So I'll move here. There's a wire up here that you should move it, but you might need to move it here too. Okay.
Okay.
So we're almost there. We're good? Okay. Okay, so if I can get your attention again, just to introduce our next speakers. Many of you probably know McGill. We have a social equity and diversity education office, which has just been around for a number of years, and we have a great team of people working on social equity and education, and we have Sarah and Tynan here today that are going to talk about a they really have gotten to know the McGill community and work on this field, and they're going to talk about inclusive leadership. So if you'd join me in welcoming Sarah and Tynan.
Thanks, guys. How are you doing this morning?
Good.
Yeah, good.
Hi.
Great. My apologies to the people who are in the first couple of rows. You might not be able to see us, but we know you're there.
Yeah.
So as Joan said, I'm Sarah. And
I'm Tynan.
And we're from the SEED office, which is the Social Equity and Diversity Education office. We're the main office on campus that deals with education on issues of equity and diversity. It's a little redundant.
Sarah and I are both equity educational advisors, which means that we're responsible for training faculty, staff, and student leaders on issues related to equity and diversity.
And I just wanted to mention quickly, we have a lot of stuff that happens within our office, but we also have the community engagement branch, which for anyone who's interested in volunteer opportunities and getting involved in the Montreal community, that's a great way to do it. And you see the website here. So we're here today to talk to you about being an inclusive leader.
What we're going to do, I guess, is divided into three main parts. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what we mean by inclusive leadership. We're going to talk as well about what the McGill context is, who we're talking about including, and why.
And then we're going to end with some practical examples of sort of what do we mean when we say inclusive leadership? What does that look like in the context of orientation?
Yeah. So one of the first things that we like to do in this type of presentation is to break down a little bit of the language that we use in the work that we do. There are three main words that we want to talk about, the words that you're no doubt familiar with, but that they have specific nuances and meanings in work around social justice. So the first word is equity. For us, equity is something that we think of as both a process and an outcome. When we think about trying to achieve equity, we believe that we need to consider the social and historical context of what's going on around us or what's going on in a particular situation. And our challenge when thinking about equity is to try and understand why inequality exists. And once we've done this, this can guide us as we try to figure out what steps to take to remedy an unjust situation.
So all of the terms that we're looking at today are terms that get used really frequently. Equity is one of those ones that you probably have heard in different contexts at different times, but it's not necessarily clearly defined. Often we think of equity as being the same as the term equal, or that like equitable treatment and equal treatment are the same thing, but we'd like to distinguish between those two in the work that we do. And the analogy that we like to use to explain this is one that you've probably heard before, but the idea is like splitting up a pie. So if you had a pie and you wanted to share it equally amongst eight people, the thing to do would be what many of us always do is to cut it in half, then cut it in quarters, then cut it into eight equal slices, right? So everyone, each of the eight people gets an equal share of the pie.
When we're thinking about dividing a pie equitably, however, that's a whole different process. So we're going to be needing to ask ourselves different questions. When we're dividing a pie equitably, we're going to be asking questions like who is hungry and why are they hungry, who has regular access to a pie and who doesn't, who has five pies sitting at home on a shelf and who has no pies. And so the outcome of an equitable sharing of a pie might mean that several people get no slices of that pie, others get significantly larger slices than some people who may have six slices, all of them different sizes.
This is fairness in the context of sharing pie.
Yeah.
So the next term we wanted to talk about is diversity. Diversity refers to, this is another one of those terms that you've heard many times before, we're referring to the differences amongst us. We find often this term gets confused with sort of focusing on individual types of difference.
So what we like to do when we think about diversity is to consider the ways that it's actually related to social inequality. So thinking about diversity in this context means that we're not talking about things like hobbies or personal preferences, but we're actually talking about intergroup inequality. We're talking about key demographic factors such as ability and disability, race, class, gender, and so on.
So we're not just necessarily talking about things like your hobbies or your eye color. This is really about sort of types of difference that really have social meaning and have an impact on sort of people's levels of access and inclusion within society more broadly. And we think that this is relevant for you guys as leaders because it's going to have a lot to do with sort of the type of environment that you create within your groups. Part of your role is to sort of facilitate people getting to know one another, that sort of thing. And that's going to mean a lot of like talking about sort of individual types of difference, you know, what kind of sports are you into, what kind of music do you listen to. But then there are also going to be dynamics that are related to things like race, class, gender, that aren't necessarily as easy to sort of parse through and are going to have different implications than just sort of those other more sort of friendly and easy to access types of difference.
So the third term that we want to talk about and is sort of is culture, and it's when we talk about culture, we're talking about shared ways of seeing, thinking, and doing.
And in the context of talking about culture, we think that it's also important to think about what culture means and how culture operates. So, you know, it's true that there are many different cultures. We live in a multicultural society, but we also have to recognize that within that context, there are sort of dominant cultures or like cultural norms and values that get a lot more attention and get a lot more sort of recognition and power within society. But then there are also I guess we would say like less powerful or sort of more marginalized cultures as well. In the context of orientation, you're going to be getting people who come from all different cultures. So you're going to be getting a lot of students who are part of a dominant culture or who are part of dominant cultures in many different ways. You're going to also be seeing students who are part of more marginalized cultures. And part of your job is going to be to try and find ways to sort of bridge those gaps and find ways of making sure that the people who are sort of less a part of a dominant culture also feel equally as included in your groups.
Yeah. So we're going to get more specific right now to the McGill context, and we're going to take a few minutes to consider who's here at McGill, who the incoming student body is likely to be. And, you know, we don't actually have... we don't ask students for demographic information when they register at McGill, so we don't always have a clear picture of exactly who's here. But in 2009 and 2010, Deputy Provost of Student Life and Learning, Morton Mendelson, did a diversity survey among the student population at McGill. And when the results of this survey were reported to Senate in 2011, we got the beginning of a snapshot of who is at McGill. We're going to talk about that a little bit.
So this slide shows you just a quick sort of distribution of some of the information that we have about who receives and in what ways people receive financial support from their families. So quickly, you can see here on the left, 65% of people who responded to the survey, so McGill undergrads, receive support from their families for room and board or they live at home. Whereas 35% have to pay for their own room and board and cover their own rent, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so also 68% of McGill students receive support from their family to help them cover the cost of tuition, which means that 32% of McGill students have to pay for their own tuition.
58% cover their own books, 58% receive support, 42% cover their own books. You get the picture. So I think what we're going to do right now is give you a chance to reflect on what this means for students at McGill. I know like many of you are coming back from having worked summer jobs. Many of the students who are going to be coming in that you're going to be working with in the course of the next week are also going to be, you know, thinking about a lot of this stuff, you know. Have they been able to secure money for their tuition? Are they dealing with student loans? Those sorts of things. So what we want to do is get you to just with the person who's next to you. Do you want to explain it?
Yeah. Take 2 minutes and discuss with the person sitting next to you ways that different access to resources can affect students' experiences of life at McGill. And then we're going to bring you back. So you have 2 minutes. Talk to your neighbor. Okay, we're gonna bring it back. We're gonna bring it back. Can you do it?
All right, we're gonna bring it back. I can get everyone's attention again. Thank you. That was effective. So if you could just get a few quick volunteers, what were some of the things you talked about, some of the ideas you came up with in terms of how this might affect an incoming student's experience at Frash, at orientation, at McGill?
Yeah. Yeah, you in the black shirt.
Yeah.
Yep, so the actual cost of going out and socializing is going to be a barrier to some students, and then you suggested a way to remedy it, which is to highlight cheaper ways of having a good time with friends. What else did you discuss? Other ideas of what the impact is going to be on incoming students? Anyone?
Okay, so just quickly a few of the points.
Oh, we have a point in the front here. Go ahead. So a lot of people coming in are going to have to start budgeting their money, and it might be the first time in their life that they're doing that for themselves. So that's going to be a barrier or a burden that they're going to have to face.
Which, for those of you who had that experience coming into university, you know that it takes a certain amount of mental energy. It takes a little bit of your time away from, you know, time you could be spending just hanging out with people, time you could be spending studying, all those sorts of things. Others?
Yeah, over here. Yeah.
So textbooks are really expensive, and a lot of you will know that for some people that means sort of going to the library a lot, photocopying things, having to take out the student loan copies and that sort of thing, which again is like another way that people spend more money or spend more energy if they don't have the money to just buy things.
And the same can be said for access to computers in that regard, right? Like if you can get a computer for the library, but what does that mean if you have to go every 2 or 3 days to the library to renew the computer? Use a different computer, download your documents all the time as an added burden to your learning experience.
So again, we bring these sorts of things up just to give you guys a sense of what some of the things are going to be that are going through your incoming students' minds. And we know that there's a pretty big sort of diversity in terms of financial resources and financial access within the body of students that you're going to be working with. So it's important to make sure that you're not making assumptions about sort of what's on people's minds, what people do have access to, and what sort of things they're going to be thinking about or are going to be sort of like their worries in the back of their head as they're participating in orientation. Make sense?
So going on with a little bit more information from the demographic survey, we also see that at least 11% of McGill undergraduate students do not identify as heterosexual, so identify instead as bisexual, homosexual, asexual, or other.
So if I understand correctly, you guys deal with groups of about 20 students, which means that at least two of your students probably could identify as something other than straight. 22% do not identify as white, so Chinese, South Asian, Arab, black, other groups of students of color.
And 20% identify as religious minorities, that is, the largest groups are Jewish, Muslim, and Buddhist, among other religions.
So again, that says something about sort of the types of difference that you're going to find in your groups, the types of considerations that you're going to have to make in terms of making sure that people feel recognized, included, that it's an open space for them to participate as they feel comfortable. So now we're going to get into some of the practical ideas of how you can actually do inclusive leadership. We've talked a bit about sort of why one would do this and what some of the things are to consider, but that doesn't necessarily tell you exactly how to deal with the types of difference that you're going to be encountering, and we want to give you a chance to think about that a little bit as well.
So the first tip that we have is to try and take the time to appreciate each member of your group as an individual. Try to find ways to personally connect with each member of your group. This could mean things like approaching people, obviously making an effort to remember their names, but also, you know, asking them perhaps what some of their fears are or their worries are coming into this university environment.
So next, be aware of group dynamics and work actively to undermine unequal power relationships. So you're going to see different things going on within your groups where some people are going to be participating a lot, some people are going to be really active in some of the decisions that the group is making about sort of what they want to do, where they want to hang out, that sort of thing. And other people are going to hang back more. Maybe you're going to notice that some people try to speak up but don't really get recognized and that sort of thing. And that's an important thing to consider as in terms of your role as a leader, in terms of your role as sort of maintaining the group and maintaining the inclusive culture of the group. When you see things like that happening, it might be important to sort of check in or say, like, oh, I noticed that, you know, this person hasn't said much about what we're doing, or check in with them individually. You know, are you feeling comfortable with the stuff that the group is doing? Is there anything that I could do to, you know, make this a little more fun for you, make it a little more engaging for you? So try and be aware of what's going on in your group and who's engaged and who's not engaged. Make sense?
The third tip is don't make assumptions. And when we talk about making assumptions, I wonder if we could just have some ideas from the group. What kind of assumptions are we trying to avoid making about our groups?
And
that everybody's going to drink a lot, okay? What else are we going to... When we think about everybody's going to... Thanks. When we think about that... what else do we want to assume that's sort of the counter of that? That's too much of a leading question, I think. I think we should try to also not assume, based on people's perhaps religion or culture, that they don't want to drink, right? So there's two sides of that, is to, often when we're talking about not making assumptions, it's about asking the person what they prefer, what they're comfortable with, engaging with people around issues such as drinking.
So you might have had an experience in the past where you think, oh, I don't know if they'd be comfortable doing this. Rather than sort of having it be an awkward thing or leaving the question open or not addressing it, what makes the most sense is just say, hey, we were thinking about doing this. Are you okay with that?
What other things might we try to avoid making assumptions about? That everybody lives in residence, yep.
And so that might have to do with, you know, if a group of people are going out after an activity, is that person going to be able to get back to their home safely, all those sorts of things? Do they have enough time? Is the transit working? All those sorts of things. Other assumptions? Yeah. Sorry, I didn't...
Access, like, based on language. Yeah. So that is going to be a big issue. It's a big issue at McGill. There are many Francophone students at McGill. There are also many students whose first language is neither French nor English, and that's definitely something that, as an orientation leader, you're going to have to really keep in mind as you navigate your group and group dynamics and inclusion within that group. Yeah.
Okay. Any other assumptions that people want to throw out, that people want to hear addressed?
Two common ones that we want to mention are sexual orientation. So trying to avoid the presumption that everybody is heterosexual in your group. We can do that by, you know, using open-ended language when we talk about dates or partners or attraction, that kind of thing. And gender identity. We also don't want to presume that we know a person's gender identity based on their appearance. So if you're not sure what personal pronouns, you know, he, she, etc., that somebody might use, how can we deal with that in a group setting? Any ideas? You know their name, so you might take clues from their name about what pronoun that they might prefer. If the name doesn't tell you, what's another way you can address that issue? Ask them, right? So it's the same as with all these assumptions. The best way to address ambiguity or uncertainty is to go ahead and ask people. Ask them in a discreet way. Ask them in private if you feel like it's a sensitive issue. But please do engage with the students in your group and ask them.
Okay. So so our last few, use open-ended language and ask questions. We've already talked about that a little bit, or quite a bit, actually. But again, this is about sort of language around relationship status, around who a person might be attracted to or who a person might be dating, around cultural identity, all those sorts of things. Just be mindful of the type of language that you're using and try and be mindful of the type of language that's being used in your group a little bit. We don't want you, you know, we're not trying to get you to police anyone's language, but sort of if you hear things that seem like they're making other people uncomfortable, if you hear things that seem like they could be making someone uncomfortable that isn't necessarily out about a particular identity, try and be mindful about the type of space that's being established.
And the last one is to give special attention to those that seem less engaged or included. So again, this is to refer back to what we were talking about earlier about culture and how culture is one of the main ways that intergroup inequality gets perpetuated. As group leaders, you're responsible for the culture in your group. And as we heard earlier from Drew, sometimes it's the little things, the things we don't even know that we did, that make a difference in somebody's life in a major way. And that can be you in this situation. If you overhear somebody making a joke about race or about sexual orientation, even if you know that they didn't mean it in a bad way, as a group leader, it's a really key moment where you can intervene, you can set a tone for your group, you can say, I presume you didn't mean anything bad by that, but actually, you know, we can't use that kind of language in our group. You can check in with a person if you feel like they're feeling marginalized within your group. So it's really on you guys to set the culture for your group, to model a good culture, and to welcome all the incoming students to McGill. I hope you guys have a great orientation week. Thanks very much.
We're just about ready to get you out of here. Could you please help us with our core value of sustainability and clean up anything on the floor, take it out, find recycling bins if you can, or garbages, keep the room clean. And first of all, before you go, we're actually going to send you out in a specific order. Everyone that has a yellow folder, if you can go out the door over here, the facilitators are going to greet you just over here. So yellow folders out here, blue and green, wait for a minute. Okay. People with green folders, if I can have your attention, green folders, can you come down and go to this side while the yellow folders are going up there? Come down and go to this door, exit here. Facilitators are going to meet you out there.
Just up there.
Okay, yellow folders. Yellow folders are all out, almost all out.
Can I ask you for a favor? One of my co-leaders, he got a different color folder than me. Am I supposed to be going with him?
Oh, okay, it just got switched. Then you could go with him and just explain to the facilitator.
Right.
Okay. Blue folders. Okay. All the blue folders. You're going to be going to the west lower field. Once we get rid of those yellow folder people, you're going out this way. Okay? Have a great day, you guys. We'll see you back here a bit later. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Yeah, thank you.
Is it a good start?
Yeah.
Good? Good. Okay.
These were left here, so
someone
comes back.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll have. Thank you. What we're doing? Yeah, we have. 12:30 lunch. 1 o'clock. We need to do the setup beforehand. I have people coming around 12:30 because we're going to be here. We caught 26 and we caught 219. One of them wants to use her laptop and bring it and change it each time. So we'll see how that. She's in the back. So she's whispering the adapter and everything.
Oh, that was so much fun. Oh, thank you.
Was it really? Are you sure?
It was. Okay. You know who I don't like?
What do you not like?
Let me list all of the people in this room who I think not very highly of. No one.
No. That was very... I got an awesome... Somebody said awesome was there leaving.
Oh, great.
I loved... Yeah. Well, I'm sure you must
people were very nice.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's always wonderful to know that it mattered, right? Because, yeah. I mean, what a wonderful opportunity to have a job where every day you have a chance to matter to people.
Yeah.
And that's a gift that not everybody gets. And but it's sometimes harder to bang smack in the face with.
Yes.
Being like, hey, look, people are listening to you. And I never ever want to take that for granted. It's such a, I'm so lucky.
Yeah.
And even on those days where like I'm stuck in traffic yesterday or at the airport and your flight's delayed, and you're just like, this is what you do for me. And how great is that? And knock on wood, haven't missed a gig yet.
Yeah.
Even with all these years of
I know, and you're off like right after now?
Yeah, I'm heading off to the airport now, and then I have a Shirley Moore night in Toronto, and then 2 on the 30th in Halifax, and then I do North Bay and Hamilton on the same day, and then I'm up to Winnipeg. And then I stop here again for a wedding on next Sunday. Yep, I just pop in. And then I do Prince Edward Island and Mount A on the same day. University of Toronto, Mississauga, and Dalhousie on the same day.
Same thing.
And then I come back to Queens and then to Carlton. So I'm really excited. Hopefully, like, any weather that kind of messes around.
Just some other stuff.
You know, 12:30. Because last year I met my...
No, 12:30.
Last year I got it right ahead of Hurricane on the East Coast. And then I was out there for 2 days. I was here for 2 days. You can go back there. So.
Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah, my question if you're ever is missing, and I understand people would know, like, I called up and said, let's get a hurricane and stuff.
Nothing was only, it's just like,
we'll find out Stephanie's
that's exactly just like, okay, just have to make it, but there can be.
Yeah, the effort that people put into planning these things, like I recognize that. And that's what I like about it, is that I did it. So I never, like as I said, I never want to be here if the remote doesn't work.
I know, I'm so sorry.
Oh, thank you. It's not to the slides. But it's nice to show the photos of the people. Yeah. That's the most fun, is that people can be like, these are real people.
Yeah.
And we go from there. Thank you for all of you for the chance to be here. And I've never gotten to do a Quebec school. I've spoken to Quebec technically because I was across the border when I used to work at the University of Ottawa. They were in the
Chapman,
which is magnificent. It's just like open stretches of the highway. And so yeah, now it's just Manitoba and Newfoundland.
Yep.
And Manitoba happens on Saturday.
You have not presented?
I have not done Manitoba, Newfoundland, or the Three Territories. But I have an interest in the Three Territories. I just, I think next spring.
That would cost a lot of money.
It would. So, but I'm putting aside, I think it would probably the whole tour would cost $5,000. And so I kind of look at that as like a donation. Because they don't get secret. So just to be able to have the experience and the opportunity to go up and speak in all three.
Mm-hmm.
Or I might do one a year. Like I might just put some money aside and every year like I'll do the Yukon and I'll do Northwest and I'll do Canada. But I've got friends teaching in all three colleges. I'll talk to them, making like $100,000 a year to teach grade 8. But apples cost $6. So.
That's silly.
And they come once a year, they come to Montreal and they fill up a cargo container of everything they need for the year.
Yeah.
Because you can't order it because they don't want to be responsible if they forget your toilet paper. Because they fly in these crates. And so once a year you go shopping and you buy everything that you need and they boat it over from Montreal. Yeah. Well, from back. But apparently the Canadian North is so beautiful that most people that have gone up there don't come back.
Come back. With North, I've done a lot of trip kayaking where you just get dropped off.
That must be here, so. And I hear that the Northern Lights are like every night and like spectacularly every season. So I'm really looking forward to getting a sample of it. 40 states are left, so.
Okay.
I often ask myself, why did we go to the University of Hawaii? Like, you ever take a moment to stop and be like, why did I go to the University of Hawaii? Why didn't I do that?
I have asked myself, because apples also cost $6.
What a dumbass move that was on my part.
My high school room to University of Texas, pool, palm trees. What am I doing?
And 114 degrees.
Yeah.
I spoke in Texas. I'm doing it again this year in September, and I've never felt like that. It was disgusting. It was the nicest people ever.
Hello?
But it was so gross. And then I went to L.A., it was 64 degrees. I hopped up the plane at LAX. It's my dream, my car again. But I drove for 2 hours and it was 112. I drove to Palm Springs, and in the course of a 2 hour car ride, it increased 40. And on the way out, it went from 110 to 70 in 15 minutes.
Oh, I'll be there in 2 minutes.
It was insane.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect. This is driving.
My walkie-talkie is
dropping. Keep telling cross groups, don't do walkie-talkies because they make squawks.
We have.
Yeah,
but it's
the first move.
It's not worth it for leaders, but for the coordinators. Otherwise, I've been on my cell phone once for an hour going, end call, hello. And this way it's, guys, who can do this? Instead of having to call every coordinator, it's, who can do this now?
It's just, I've always said, I'm like, because what happens, they go off your speakers, and so I just like, get little headpieces and a little Secret Service thing, because everyone gets to go like.
and you can. It's great because you can get a $5 more a day, you get a long distance frequency, so it acts like you can go from here to downtown, anywhere downtown.
That's the fucking thing, coordinating, just communicating with each other. When your cell phones don't work indoors, and you miss them because you're busy.
Hi.
There's nothing like coordinating, they always love watching this, they're off in the corner. 17 missed calls. Anyway, guys, thank you
so much for being here.
It's been an amazing week, okay?
I'm going to go run that and grab that.
Do you need to take care of this guy, okay?
Do you need me at any other point today?
He is, but I find that sometimes he forgets
it. Can you just say it's the first time?
Who's down there? Christine is there.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to get over there.
And I'm back next Sunday, so hopefully like, it's all behind us. Montreal is kind of like, I'm a bad guy.
Yeah, I like that dude.
But so I'll head to the wedding next Sunday. And, too bad I land. I go to the wedding and I leave before the reception.
Hi, how are you? How's it going?
I know you. You're a TV star. I saw you in the video.
So you're the second person to it. How did this morning go?
Very good.
It went well. Okay, great.
No one threw anything at me, so.
No one threw anything.
Except for compliments.
Oh. Yes.
Oh, oh, yeah.
It goes like this. I'm a tally board. And I did knock over the flag. It would have been the Quebec flag, and then that would have been like a big
That's. Oh my gosh! So you're.
This is my first time.
I honestly thought that when I knocked them, like, if that's the Quebec flag, and it's going over.
And we didn't order these, eh? I don't. I just realized. Like, oh, it's I guess there was something.
You're
not all sure there might have been something here.
Right.
Like, Montreal.
It's a Montreal flag.
Is that Montreal or
McGill?
Miguel
Canada.
Montreal represents
like
four immigrants.
I will say this, I love the Quebec flag.
Did they sign in with you this morning?
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks. Be here all week. Be here all week.
No, I'm very excited. It's really great that you're able to do this as a full time.
Oh, it's been, and you know what? At first it was just like, oh, I hope I can get by. Now it's like I've had to turn down 4 or 5 TEDx events.
Really?
Yeah. It just eventually gets to the point where it's hard because I got an agent, and they've been doing this for years, and so it's hard. Like when they ask, and I put it on YouTube, and they were like, "Don't." Like TED stuff is cool because it's high quality and looks good.
Yeah.
Everything else, don't give it away for free, and that's tough for me because I'm like, well, I don't want to ever be the guy who says no because of money. And they're like, the problem is that like, if you want to do this for a long time, and I don't want to ever go back to working for anyone else, then, you know, eventually you just have to do less for more. And you can't, if someone finds out you did it for this, then they're going to be like, oh, well, you know, why should we pay you 10 grand? Because that's all my corporate stuff, 10 to 15,000. And so if they found out, oh, what are we doing to McGill for X? But I know that certain close friends of mine would never go around telling me that. So, plus, the thing is, the more corporate stuff I do, the more I can come back. Like I work with my friends at Rockman, who they do the best they can budget-wise, but I never want to stop working with them. Same with Ian, right? Like, I was like, it doesn't... Because now I get to do so much more corporate stuff, I can do more stuff. It's not about money nearly as much as it's about time. And what happens is, you know, Rodman sets up, we need 2 weekends. And I'm like, see, I have no problem giving you 2 weekends, but, like, not that much. The problem is that other people want those weekends. So it really becomes, as long as, for me then, it's just like, hey, as long as we work the schedule, as I said to Ian, like simulations and stuff for the upcoming year, drop me a line. I'd love to be a part of it. And it's not a question of, you know, well, I don't know if you can afford it. You know, I'll always start there.
Well, because you've got a really good reception. And you're, I do, because I wanted to talk to you at some point, too, because I have a background in improv and theater.
Ah!
So I do speaking, and I do workshops, so I do all sidelines.
Yeah.
And I find, like, it's really fun and very interactive.
That's a lot of, it's once you like, if you like audiences, that's just what it is, right?
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's performance. It's just different types, right?
Yeah. So... Exactly, because it's that thing if you hit a chord with them, and you're like, I showed the lollipop, the TEDx to our facilitators.
You've got super facilitators, leaders.
Yeah, and it was just like, it was just really interesting kind of watching the reception, because I said, well, you're probably going to do like a variation, so the 7 minutes is a great way, and then it helped them understand like their own, and then be better prepared, and it's just like, it's neat. You have to make it accessible.
Yeah, the 6:20 too is I'm more grateful to TED for telling me you only have that much time than.
Yeah.
The same thing with today. Like I haven't
today I didn't actually cut much out of today's presentation. I took out a few extra stories and a little bit of expanding, and I was worried. I'm like, because you're always worried that what you cut out is what really connects with people. Mm-hmm. So there's a much longer story about Allison. Like, I talk a lot more about who she is and the background and her relationship with her mom. I talk a lot more about my experience with the double-sided sheet of paper usually when I have 60. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, you got 40. So cut out everything but just the core. Yeah. And so it was interesting to see that I'm like, oh, that still seems to land. Yeah. So it's sometimes really valuable to be like, what is the ultimate meat of it, right? And because it's nice to have the meat, potatoes, and vegetables.
Yeah.
But it's nice to be reminded that, you know what, ultimately all that stuff is extra. So here's the main pieces. Like, yeah. you can't just look good on paper. You have to matter. Don't live by the list. And, you know, those two little stories at the end. Because I usually don't do both the check story and the lollipop story together. They're two different closers.
Yeah. No, and it's so neat to kind of, like, understand that. This is my flow.
Yeah, now
I do the same thing.
I very rarely do them back to back because they're the same story.
Yeah,
and like they're different stories, but they're the reason for telling the story is the same, which is here's a story about how you have an impact when you're not paying attention. So rarely do I do them back to back, except for orientation leaders, because then you have a reminder that they're both orientation related, right? Mm-hmm. They're both about what you did in this week, so you can do them back to back, but. And usually I never would. I do one at the beginning. Yeah, now I'm taking from comedian Louis C.K. I'm going to take the lollipop. I get to see him at the end of September. He's my congratulations to you finished the tour. He's doing Just for Laughs in Toronto. Yeah, I'm very excited. But he says he takes his closing bit and makes it his starting bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
I was so, like, he's so brilliant.
Yeah. So I'm going to be starting.
Yes. All the stuff that I have to work on.
Well, he took that from George Carlin. Because he does a bit on, there's one on him on YouTube talking about how angry he got at George Carlin when he heard Carlin say that on an interview. He's like, well, I do my special, throw it out, and then give myself 2 years to have another show good enough for a special. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you dick. Like, I've been doing the same stuff for 15 years. It took me this long to do it, and you're telling me that you do it again and again and again.
Yeah.
He's like, I was so angry with him, but like so admiring him, and now you see that he's done the same. You probably saw HBO's Talking Funny with Ricky Gervais and Jerry Seinfeld. It's on YouTube. Ricky Gervais, Jerry Seinfeld, Louis C.K., Chris Rock. And they're just sitting in four chairs talking about comedy and how to do it and seeing the different processes and how different Seinfeld is than all the other three, how insecure or interested Gervais is in who would strike me as the one that seems to care the least about what the hell anyone thinks, but he's the one who's asking, but what about this, and what about that, and don't you worry about this.
Yeah.
So that was a really, and Louis C.K. just keeps coming off as the most down-to-earth, sort of like everyman who's just like, and that really impressed me. And then Chris Rock, who's my hero, is just, you know.
Well, there are four great examples. Keep doing this. Four great examples.
And Brian is another one to listen to. Squeaky, squeaky clean.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, you'll never find anyone makes fun of Brian Regan. He's just so good. And his favorite one is how he wishes he could be one of the 13 men alive who walked on the moon. Because he's like, every time you're at a party, someone's just like, you know, me monster, me, I, me, and I've done this, me.
Yeah, the
check one, two.
12 at 1. That's it. That went well for you, though?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So I'm going to just check a few things. I have one more. If anyone comes back, somebody left their glasses here, so I'm just going to leave them here. Yeah, at the end of the day, I can see if anyone left them here. I won't be that long. I have a netbook for room 26, and you want to get one more for income 219 as a backup.
Jack?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, mother, and kick out the jams. Ooh. What do you want me to say? I really have a hard time with that kind of stuff. 18 inches. That's over here. So do I look cool, dude? Do I look cool enough for Mabel? I'd like to see a photo of her. We did see a photo of her. I couldn't really tell who she was. It was very difficult to make it out. I can't see anything with these on. I don't know how anybody wears sunglasses. I had a pair of Ray-Bans once. I found them in a garage sale for a nickel. I think I stole them. I don't know. Never use them. There's a lot of water here. We can probably start a war.
Okay, sounds good here.
So, you like that guy, Drew? Yeah, was he a cool dude? Has he had your hat kind of hat on? It's time, Jamie, you got to take the hat off because it's no longer cool if all these kids are wearing them. You're too old now. It's the same hat. The James Bond retro look is gone, I think. Felix Leiter. Do you know who Felix Leiter is? Yeah, did you ever watch a James Bond movie? Yeah, well, who's his buddy in the FBI? Felix Leiter, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he wears that hat. Yeah, in all the movies, in the 60s. Fuck, was it?
You were talking about the same Felix in the 60s.
Yeah.
Because in the 90s, they changed Felix.
To what?
He was a black guy.
Oh, that's right, he became a black guy. But isn't he a white guy again in the new ones? Yeah. Whatever. I don't know why they changed him to a black guy. Felix had a sex change. I don't know what the fuck, you know. But well,
why did
he have a change? Well, because people don't keep the same job forever. But his buddy is his buddy, you know. Well, James Bond is James Bond. He never gets a promotion. How long has he been working there? Since 1954? Never a promotion. He's just 007. Can I be 001? Can I move up? Why aren't I in charge? He never asks himself these questions, does he? He just enjoys being the bum boy that goes around to fuck people over. And he never once, you know, thinks maybe there's something else. Unless it was in that Never Say Never Again. Did you see that? Okay, so you remember Never Say Never Again. What does he do? It opens up, he's in a fat clinic, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he opens up his suitcase of what's in there. Fucking caviar, champagne, cigars, cognac. It seems to me that James Bond is really an underachiever. I mean, nobody could really be happy with that all their lives. Did you want to be James Bond? I wrote a poem about James Bond when I was 15 or so. 15 or 16, can't remember. Hey!
The hat's out.
The hat, Jamie, is fucking last year's style. It's over. It's over, dude. Over. You look like, like an aging hipster. An aging retro hipster.
No, that's out, too.
It's out.
It's out.
If everybody's wearing it, it's no longer in. Is it?
Really don't care if it's in or what's out.
No, you wear what you want for yourself. I wear my hats for other reasons. I wear my hats because they look good and because I need something on my head.
Because the room's my head out the wind.
Your hair gets room by wearing
hats. It's room by the wind.
Well, I guess not. We're not going to accept that one. Now, she said you thought. Now, she's finding the way she said
one. That's one. So I have to
have a little. Yeah, well, that's all right. So
they're coming at 4:30. Sorry?
What do you mean we have to say?
What do you mean we?
This is we, isn't it?
We.
This thing went to sleep last night.
Stay were the Nazis, and it was like the guy and his fucking wife beater. And then there were the geeks like this, and it was like, just stay away from these people. It's very dangerous to be associated with them. But be careful of the Nazis, because they can really beat the crap out of you, so you gotta make sure that you stay on the right side until you can't enter.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I don't think. The glasses don't suit you.
You
got glasses. You can't wear glasses when you're in glasses.
Well, when I take my glasses off and I'm in the sun, I need my sunglasses, I guess.
Well, no. Not these imitations.
Do you have my sunglasses? Is that a problem?
Yeah.
You walk away and leave. I can't find the believer. That's a weak setup. For okay, Jim, explain me this. Why is it that let me never went to university?
Who?
You.
Hey? You didn't want to? Bullshit. Yeah, I know. They all wiggle about. I don't know.
They just like that. That's the 58mm model, I think. Made in China, right? Oh, no, the made in Walkway. Yeah, large. Aviator large. So they actually don't suit your face, do they? Too big, right?
Way too big.
Yeah, I can tell. You see, I need the next size down. So I don't want them like that.
I usually need large, but sometimes I need smaller, especially when it comes to these. I don't think this guy used his shades. So who had these? Who had Mr. Cool shades, eh? This is genuine James Bond territory, these here. From the beginning, the series was about product placement. Cars, guns, aviator glasses. Diamonds, chicks,
dicks, whips.
that's on the turn off every 4 minutes.
That's why. I don't understand. I don't understand laptops. What's this bag? Bag of shit. What's this?
Hello. Ooh. I do have a loud voice, though. I don't know. Are we a little too loud?
No,
oh, you're going to be here for it.
So you guys.
Oh. Wireless mic or that's you. If we're talking right here, we don't need a wireless mic. But if we want to walk around, obviously we need a wireless mic. Any preferences?
I'll probably be up there.
Yeah.
It's simpler that way.
Yeah.
Is the wireless mic like easy?
It's easy. This sounds better.
Okay.
Great. So I'm going to take them over to Leacock 26 and 219 and just go there.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's me and you. We're going to 26.
Yeah, but you need this stuff.
Three samosas. You guys going to give us the extra samosas? Oh, here's a little lesson. This is the schedule. This is the schedule. Where's the wife? Alexandra, I just talked to her. That's 1 to 2:30. And that's here?
Yep.
2:45 to 3.
Yep.
First aid workshop.
Mm-hmm.
So, done then. You got to leave at 4?
No, that's not it.
No?
It's this one.
Okay, to 4:30. Would, that's it, discovering the governor. We not, are we covering them?
Yeah, we're doing this.
And, but we're not doing this?
No, we're doing this.
Yeah, this guy? Not doing this?
No.
Okay.
And we're yes. back at 3:30.
So we got a break from where?
From 2:30 to 3:30.
Yes.
No.
Okay. Are you going to be around?
Negative.
Are you leaving early?
No.
Okay. So if you, if that was the Friday, and if you weren't going to be here, then Frank would come over and help us?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's going to end.
Maybe I could stay.
Close at 4:30. We're not out of here after 5, I don't think. Are we all set up? This is the one they're using?
Yeah, they're going to be switching laptops.
What happened to that other little one that was here? It's gone.
I don't know. They got 3 other rooms now.
230,
226, and 219.
I didn't realize. What's in it? Is it all, it's not overflow? Or it's just
no,
separate events?
Different breakouts.
Okay.
I'm going to check 232.
Okay.
Yeah. I wish that I'd gotten a nicer one.